Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Lowdown. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Jonathan Moss. John, big warm welcome to the show.
Hi there, good to be here. Looking forward to a good chat over the next sort of 45 minutes.
And John, as you told me off air, you're joining me from, well, what I would have thought would be in sunnier climes in Australia.
Yeah, currently in Sydney, just enjoying, well, it was sunshine, but now it's a bit of rain, but we're coming into the Australian summertime, so things to look forward to.
Fantastic stuff. And look, as you know, where we begin on the show, could you please take us through your earliest football memory?
Yeah, I was trying to think about this earlier today, and I think it was probably going to Sunderland matches at an early age. So my dad still is a season ticket holder at Sunderland, and we used to go to the old Roker Park. I think my first game was in 1975. I went as a 5-year-old, and I used to get really bored after about 70 minutes and want to go, much to the annoyance of my dad, who used to put me at the you were standing then at that point. He used to put me right at the very front or sit me on the barrier, and I think after about 70 minutes I got to a point where I'd had enough, and I think he probably threatened never to take me to the match again because I was making him leave a bit early. And so, and I think playing was maybe playing for the school at 6 or 7. I think that was probably my earliest memories of football, really.
Fantastic. And obviously when football and your name comes and collides together, we all think about refereeing. I mean, take us back to the start of that. How soon did that become, an aspiration of yours from going in grassroots to working all the way in the Premier League?
Yeah, to be totally truthful with you, the last thing I ever wanted to be was a referee. I always wanted to be a footballer, so obviously growing up, played for the school and then the district and then for the county and then signed for Sunderland at 14, which was like a dream come true, and was there for a couple of years before getting released. And then I spent a bit of time in America before going to Huddersfield, Hartlepool, Luton, Millwall, did the rounds, and then sort of settled back into sort of semi-pro life. Didn't really think about refereeing. I'd done a qualification when I was at sixth form college. I qualified as a rugby referee and a basketball referee and a football referee. I got sent off when I was about 28 or 29 playing for one of the local teams. And I'd sort of beginning to fall out of love with playing a little bit. I was getting a bit frustrated. I retaliated probably when I shouldn't have done. And I went in the bar afterwards, tried to get the referee not to send in the sending off, as you did. And he just said, basically, if you think you can do any better, have a go yourself. And I thought, I may as well have a bit of a go. So I did and started doing the next week after. I served a suspension for about 6 weeks because that's what you got when you got sent off, £35 in 6 weeks. And after I'd done that, I started refereeing in the local Sunday League. And gradually made my way up through the leagues, and then eventually got onto the conference, and then onto the Football League, and then onto the Premier League. It was just, I think the thing that I found really hard when I first started refereeing was I'd gone from this dressing room atmosphere where everyone was laughing, joking, as you do, taking the mick out of each other, talking about the game in the bar afterwards, to a very lonely existence as a referee, because when you start on a Sunday morning, you're by yourself. And even though I was refereeing a lot of the players that I knew around Leeds and things like that, it was still very different. And even though the games were going well and the players liked the way I was refereeing, yeah, I just found it really difficult to begin with. And then you start working with different refs, and it's the same banter, and it's just a smaller group. And then you before you know it, you're into that refereeing and you're taking it a bit more seriously, and you're moving up the leagues, and it becomes a bit more challenging, and it's a good thing, really.
And did you ever manage to keep in touch with that referee from the start?
I did actually. He actually
Oh,
ran the
wow.
line to me a few years later, and he sort of stayed at that lower level. But you meet some great people as you go along, some people that helps and guide you through. Like on a Sunday morning, there was a guy called Steve Andrews, who was a prison officer, and he really liked the way I refereed. He was giving me loads of games, and then you go up to the next level. He then moved up to sort of the next level up and took me with him. And it's just part of being a referee is a bit of luck, and it's a bit of being in the right place at the right time, but also working hard and trying to work on your craft, if you like.
And obviously we'll speak about your later work later on in the podcast related to education and providing that pathway now for referees. But going back to the start when you were coming through, would you say what would the culture be like in terms of, was it more of a fraternity and a brotherhood in terms of working with other referees graduating through the levels, or was there a little bit of a spike and a little bit of competitiveness there as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. That I never found that, to be honest with you. I always sort of when you started off at the grassroots, there was always there was a referee society that you joined your local branch. So mine was, I think, Wharfdale, and there was always people in there, like old hands, that would help and guide you and give you advice and look after you. And you tended to run the line to these people in cup finals. And there were some brilliant referees that never made it to the professional game, who I worked with along the way, who were fantastic. And there was also some guys that were on the Football League and some guys that I ran the line to on the Premier League, and you watch and learn from them. Yeah, there's always people that want the games that you get, but I tend to just concentrate on me, try to listen to advice and try and get a little bit better each time. I know there are some people that got worried about what every game everybody else was getting, but I was never that bothered about that. I just sort of enjoyed the games I got and gone with it.
Percent. And was it, did you find it was kind of a natural progression for yourself going from grassroots, conference, football league, Premier League? It was organic enough.
Yeah, I mean, it took me 5 years to get to the Football League. It was quite a fast, sort of fast pace. And then I got onto the conference after about 3 years, and then 2 years later, I refereed the conference playoff final, which was Carlisle and Stevenage. It was at that moment probably where it was live on Sky. There was only 13,000 people in there, but for me, it was a massive game. I sort of pinched myself to think, how have I got here? And then, there's a chance you're gonna go to the Football League. I got promoted that season. Started off at Shrewsbury Rochdale, and then you're thinking, this is brilliant. Grant Holt was playing, and there's players that you sort of half knew, and then it's a different kind of refereeing. There's pressure because of the crowd there, but the football is much easier to read, and you tend to, if you've played a little bit of football, you tend to know where it's going to go. You have an idea what a bad tackle is, and you talk to the players, as because I wasn't that far away from when I played myself, so it was like 5 years. I still thought like a footballer, if you like. And so I knew how to talk to the players, and they seemed to like that. And then you sort of get found out because you realize that it's not as easy as you think, and there's more scrutiny and things you might get away with at lower levels with one camera angle, you no longer get away with. And then 2 years later, you're refereeing the championship, and there's like 20 cameras, and every decision is scrutinized. And then you take it up to the Premier League, and it's a whole different world.
100%. But I mean, you said it best yourself there. You're going from grassroots to refereeing and officiating a conference final in front of 13,000 people, EFL, you go through the Premier League. Obviously, like, there's a multitude of skill sets, right, John, that make up kind of that refereeing skill set. But would you say there would have been one key strength of yours that would have been earmarked over years that, I mean, I would have said solidified your raise or would have kind of unlocked and opened up doors for yourself?
Yeah, I suppose I'd obviously I worked in education. I'd been a head teacher. I was never really super officious, which I was really conscious of, because being a teacher, you don't want the first thing people are going to say is, oh, I'm not a kid or anything like that. So you wanted to not be that bad. I've always been like an all right man manager of people. I can generally suss people out and talk to them in the right way, and that sort of, and know when to have a joke and when not to. Don't always get that right, but you learn as you go through. And that generally has been a good thing for me because I can deal with the police before the game. I can deal with security, the clubs. I'm quite approachable after the game. And therefore, people tend to like the way that you officiate. You look, I'm there's probably football fans that will listen to this podcast and go, God, he was a terrible referee and he made X, Y, and Z mistake. But that's football, right? And what they've got to realize in the 500 games, they can probably remember two or three things that you didn't get right. And that then forms their opinion of how good you were as a match official. But there's more than that that goes into refereeing. There's a whole magnitude of stuff. And we make probably 300 decisions a game. You know, some of them are more high profile than others. And people forget that you get one look at something at full speed and it can often be skewed because you'll see something on like Sky Sports or ESPN, which will be slow mode, multiple camera angles, and you're going, well, how did the referee get that wrong? But the reality is it's completely different to what you see. And no camera, apart from ref cam, which is, you know, the latest thing, will ever give you the perspective of what you see as a ref. We see in to out. You as a spectator see out to in. So it's a little bit different.
That difference into it, out to in, like the way you've put it there, it's crazy how that will go over many people's head. And you're saying, like, it's obviously you're under enough constraints. Then we speak about the magnifying glass at the Premier League. You know, once you make that step up, I assume there's some bit of transition there where it's like a pinch yourself moment. And there's some bit of a transition period. But for you, what truly kind of separated the Premier League officiating there as opposed to any other league that you would have before?
I think Premier League is the biggest league in the world, undoubtedly, because it has the biggest global audience. I don't necessarily think it's got the best players in the world because other leagues have great players. But what it has is a brilliant product. And that's because of the style of play, the full stadiums. And I think the way that the English referees and Australian referees, we've got an Australian referee in Jared, officiate those games. You let a bit more go. It's end-to-end. There's a physicality. The biggest step up as a match official is that it's still 11v11, right? And the crowd is the crowd, and you don't really take that into account because it's in the background. But it's everything else that goes with it. And what our youngest referees struggle with when they first get onto the list is that everyone's got an opinion on how you referee, and you know, everyone likes the notoriety of being a Premier League referee, but then you never get anything written nice about you on Instagram or on X or TikTok. There's always you making a mistake and or whatever. It's that stuff that clouds people's judgments, and some people can handle that and some people can't. And there's sort of, we talk about this quieting in the noise. So I never looked at social media. Other people might bring it to my attention and think it's funny to send you stuff. But you've got to just close all that out, and you've got to just believe in what you're doing and surround yourself with people that you trust. Because I have known referees that will just keep ringing people until the person that on the 13th call that says to them, yeah, you got that right. But in reality, you know when you've got something right or wrong. You know, you become adept to knowing what's going to be showing on match of the day and what's not, which are going to be those grey area challenges that are going to be highlighted. You're acclimatized to that in game, because the nuances of refereeing are that everything slows down when there's a decision. It's a bit like a tennis player. Like if we played Andy Murray, me and you, the ball would be past us before we've even moved, because we're not used to that level. But at the top level, they look at how they throw the ball up. They've already moved into that. And it's very much like that when you're refereeing. You know where to stand. You've gotten that position. You know what's going to happen. And then you make a judgment based on that moment. Everything slows down in that moment. So the hardest thing for the transition, why the Premier League is a difficult league to referee, and demonstrated in the last round of appointments where it's standing on the foot, created a number of stories, whether it was a VAR intervention or not, is that everything is magnified and someone will always have an opinion on you as a person, as a referee, and you have to learn how to handle that and move on from it and believe in what you're doing. That's why we have sports psychologists, we have sports scientists, we have people that we can talk to, and we talk, learn about parking decisions, releasing the balloon, whatever you want to call it, and moving on. Yes, we analyze, we hold on to something, and then once we've analyzed it, we let go of it, because you don't want to be carrying around decisions all the time. Because, as I say, 300 decisions, there might be one, two that are contentious that you, and there's different kinds of mistakes you make as a referee. There's the one that you shouldn't make, which is the bad one, but the ones that you can understand why you made because of the angle that you had. And sometimes the players think the same as you, because everyone just accepts the decision you make. And other times they don't, and that's when you know that you've got something wrong, and you know that's when you analyze and try and make sure you don't make that mistake again.
And the way you've put it there, I mean, you nearly need to have the skin of a rhino.
Yeah.
You know, and there's something there in terms of, it'd be interesting to hear more, and you know, some of your colleagues that you would have worked with, some of the best referees that you see nowadays, that must be immutably identifiable trait, just being able to park it to the side and move on when it gets to Monday morning. So in terms of yourself over time, I suppose when we speak about decision making, there's more than 300 decisions to make in a game, John. In terms of your own decision making, had you a framework that you had utilized? Had you a framework to kind of reevaluate your process when it got to a Monday morning? And did that change over the years, or did it even evolve?
Yeah, so when you first get onto the referee list, you're on like a roller coaster, if you like. I don't mean metaphorically, I mean metaphorically. Yeah. So you get a great appointment, you have a great game, and you're on a real high, and then something goes wrong and you're on a real low. Yeah, and what I try to tell the young referees now, and the referees that we're working with in the A-League and the Premier League referees that I work with, is you try to flatline a little bit, right? So you don't go over the top when something goes well, because you know you're one decision away the next week from something changing. And you try and make the peaks and troughs a little bit smaller and not as deep. So in game situations, and we've just had our young referees on tonight, we've done a Teams call with them, and we showed them a number of clips where the decisions are really in the border. They're from some of our Premier League games, some of the games, international games, but they're right in the margins. And we try to get them to think about what clues you could have and use as a referee. So people tend to, when you're watching it as a spectator, you look at what the forward does, yeah? How he falls and whether he's dived or not. But the reality, what you should do is look at defender's actions. Defender will often, his feet will be where the foul has occurred. So sometimes you make a mistake, whether it's inside or outside the area or penalty or not, because you look at where the attacker fell, how he fell, and your eyes become focused on that. The answer is where the defender's feet are. So we looked at a Manchester United clip tonight. Kyle Walker penalty, referee gives it on field, he gets caught out, Sam Barrett. And then he's catching up, he makes the decision, and the VAR decides to overturn it. We won't talk about that. But I said to our young referees, just look at Kyle Walker. He's off picture. He's accepted the decision. Right? So the clue is, whether you've got it right or not, that Kyle Walker is like walking away thinking, I've just given away a penalty. And having worked with Kyle Walker, he's not, if he doesn't think you've got it right, he's very good at telling you what the outcome should have been. He's accepted it. Right? He's gone off the screen. So that's something that we can learn as referees, is we've got to be like detectives. Yes, we see something at full speed and you want to blow your whistle, like the assistant sees a crossover and they want to put the flag up, and they've got to really work hard to think, no, that's an optical illusion. I've got to keep it down because it's tight. It's the same with us as referees. You see something sometimes, you think that's a penalty, and then you look around and nobody wants it. So then you've got to reevaluate. Have I seen what I think I've seen? What's everyone saying? What's the defender doing? Sometimes the defender will give themselves away by holding their hands up. We looked at a clip where a League Two player had caught someone, and it's a potential red or a second yellow. He puts his hands on his head and he just waits to be sent off by the referee. He literally just, he can't help it. He just, that's his natural reaction to it. So we're trying to get referees to think a little bit outside the box. And that was part of my process, slowing everything down, taking all the information. Obviously, we had comms, people were speaking to us, and then trying to make the right outcome. We don't always get to the right outcome, but at least giving people the opportunity to give an opinion, look at around what's the action, and then and making what you hope is going to be the right decision. So when I sent off Sadio Mane, Man City versus Liverpool, high foot on the goalkeeper coming out, my good feeling as a player was that he didn't mean to do that. That's an accident. Yeah, so I looked and I thought, I think this is a yellow card. That was my first gut feeling. And then I thought, right, has he endangered the safety of the opponent? Yes, he has. He's just caught him with his studs in his face. I go and look at the goalkeeper, so I don't do anything. I've got the goalkeeper, he's got stud marks on his face. They're calling the trainer on, he's now putting the neck brace on. The outcome has to be a red card. That's what the expectation is. So sometimes you might have a good feeling, and then you've got to process and put everything through the prism of Premier League football, the expectation, what does football expect from this? And those are all the things that you're going through your head in that split second before you make the decision. I know it
There's an
sounds
awful lot
ridiculous.
we haven't even touched upon VAR.
Yeah, no, exactly.
There's an awful lot there to unpack, and yeah, that was a memorable one. I remember, Jesus, I was up at 5 in the morning in San Francisco watching that Man City Liverpool game 8 years ago now, I think. But you know, you're talking about Premier League there, and you're talking about refereeing at the highest of levels, where there's just no game we can throw away. You know, each and every moment matters. Not that the others don't, but each and every moment matters more than most. It's magnified, it's put through the pressure cooker, so on and so forth. So when we think about experiences and we think about events that kind of shaped your approach today, I mean, we spoke about just one there. Was there any others that kind of really stood out to you that kind of gave you that time to pause, reflect, and change your approach, or kind of adapt and evolve?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you look at those big decisions you made over the years, whether it be, I was involved in a very famous game at Tottenham, Liverpool, where we give two penalties to Tottenham. It was a game where 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, everyone's watching. There's a potential offside decision, the communication system wasn't working very well. I had to go over to the assistant referee. So you reflect on that. I sent off Jamie Vardy in 2016, I think it was, when Leicester won the trophy. Did I need to send him off? Was a question I asked myself. And you have three options when someone goes down the penalty area. You give a penalty, you caution them for simulation if you think it is, and you also have the option to do nothing, so to wave it away. If I had my time again, would I coach young referees to go looking for to caution Jamie Vardy? Do I think he dived? I think he did. I think it's the right decision. But could you just wave it away and not have to make a decision if you don't think it's a penalty? So there's all things that you look back in your career and think, could they have done that differently? And then you have to frame that in. It's in that moment you've got to make a split second decision. You think you make what you hope is the right decision. There'll always be people in different camera angles that have a different view. And I think what we're trying to coach our younger referees now is that to have the same mindset as players. So we as referees overanalyze anything. You'll hear our young referees talking about a throw-in that they got wrong on the halfway line and going over it afterwards. And we're saying to them, do you think the players are still talking about that when they go into the dressing room about a misplaced pass? The only time they talk about stuff is when it leads to a goal or a mistake that's match changing. And that's the same mentality that we should have as referees. We're going to make mistakes just like the players are. We'll try to minimize those mistakes, but they're not game defining. What clubs we judge, cl what clubs judge us on as the key match incidents. And those are the ones that we've got to be really on the ball for and try and get right. Those are the ones that matter to clubs. And I think the biggest thing I've learned since I stopped refereeing and I had the role with the PGMOL and then in Scotland, and had a lot more contact with clubs at this point, was the level of detail that clubs go into. And I didn't realize that when I was active. So just, you know, how they set up for corners, why they get annoyed at us because we do certain things. And I just wish I knew then what I know now in terms of what I can do to make the game better than it was. So I think one of the things we're trying to bring into our game in Australia is we have a full-time analyst. We had the same at the PGMOL. We do our homework on clubs. That's not prejudging players. We just look how they set up, how they surround match officials. Every club now, I think apart from three in the Premier League, has got a set piece coach. You know that corners, even goal kicks, everything is set up. Obviously, we've had over the last few years the Brighton model of the really short corner, trying to suck clubs in and a quick transition. So we as referees have to know about that, have to understand what the club's trying to achieve. So we brought set pieces coaches in and talk us through their week and how they work free kicks. Why is it important to get the ball back 10 yards? I think the more we understand about how the game is played, because people think we don't know anything about football, right? They think we just turn up, blow a whistle, get in our cars and go home, and that's the end of it. We don't think about it until the following Saturday, but that's not true. We all love football. We're all immersed in it. We're fans. I mean, Australia, I got up early to watch Sunderland all through the playoffs. We were up till 4 o'clock watching the final, and we live and breathe football. We just happen to be not a player now, not a coach, just a referee, right? But that's part and parcel of the game. So one of the things we're trying to develop, and I think we're getting better at, is having a better relationship with clubs. Because if you can have a conversation with the manager afterwards about tactics and about the way that the game is being played and why you came to that conclusion, rather than just relying on the laws of the game, it's a much better conversation. And I think when I went to see Premier League managers about a refereeing performance or about how we were officiating, we were able to have those kind of conversations. I don't ever think that I know more than Marco Silva or anything like that. I just want to get as much knowledge off them and understand where they're coming from. And you probably read somewhere that sort of the second week in the job, Jurgen Klopp rang me on my phone and just said, can I talk to you about the referee from Saturday at Fulham? And I was like, well, I'm trying to think, nothing happened in that game. It was a good game. I think it finished 2-2. He said, look, our analyst has just looked at why Firmino hasn't touched the ball more than 5 times. And I'm like, oh, right. He said, I'm going to send you a video clip now. Will you have a look at it? And then come back to me. So I had a quick look at it. And the referee was how we traditionally coach him to stand during play. He was in the right places. Before I had spoken to Jurgen Klopp, I always said, yeah, good movement, yeah. But the fact is, all the channels that Liverpool were trying to play, our traditional model of movement didn't work because he was always in the way and he always blocked off that forward pass. So that was like a bit of a game changer for me. So I sent that to all the observers. I sent it to all the referees and said, look, this is the feedback we've got. We need to change this. We can't be prescriptive to how we think it is because the game's changing. We need to move with it. And that sort of started the journey with, we got all the Premier League clubs to start sending us clips in, things they weren't happy about, whether it's Arsenal had this tactic about they would engage the referee at a free kick around the edge of the area. And they would then move the ball. So the referee would walk the wall out, and as he's coming away from the wall, an Arsenal player would engage the referee. So he'd ask him a question. And while he's asking a question, then move the ball back 2 yards. So then the wall is now 12 yards away. You have the ability to lift it over the wall and to move it. You think it's not an advantage to move the ball backwards, but that just allowed them to whip the ball over a little bit. And that was a tactic. So we went back and looked at all the free kicks, and sure enough, that was something they did. Unless we knew that, how could you possibly know the dark arts? And it's not just Arsenal, that every club had something that they did, which was trying to gain an advantage, because it's all about the Beresford 1% is all about could be the difference between winning and losing a game. So modern refereeing is about being up to speed with that and knowing all the tactics and the dark arts and trying to understand what the rationale behind that is. Yes, we're going to miss things because people evolve all the time. And this has been going on for years, right? If you think about going back to Sam Allardyce in his Bolton days where he would set someone in front of the goalkeeper and then run out at the last minute. It's always happened. It's just that we've got higher skill, better people now doing it as a job, trying to find ways to circumvent and gain advantage. So we as referees have got to move with that and understand what clubs are trying to achieve by different tactics. The Aston Villa, sorry, just last thing. The Aston Villa set piece coach said, "Look, we always do our fancy corner in the first two corners of the game." He said, "Because the players can't remember after that, so we have to get it out of the way quickly." I said, "Great, that's good for us to know, because if you're going to do a short one, we need to know that we're out of the way." So them being able to come to us and say, "Look, one of the corners, we're going to move the ball to the edge of the area. If you stand there, you're in the way." That's not, we're not going to share that with anyone. We're just going to move out of the way so we don't get in the way as a referee. I think that's good communication and working together as a team, yeah? Because it's all part of, we want to be part of that game that makes the product better.
It's remarkable insight and an unbelievable way how to garner another 1%. And, you know, on top of that, a huge commitment to making the game better. And it sounds like, you know, such an unforgivable position where you're making all these adjustments, you know, you're removing your biases, never assuming things, but all for the hope of making a better product on the field. It's really remarkable insight from yourself, John. What I'm curious to unpack a bit more is, obviously, you speak about officiating, right? It's not just a product on the field. You're managing a team of staff on the day, as you said earlier, you're speaking of police and security, managing two separate benches. Now, you probably lived through, I would say, since I've been alive, the biggest adjustment, I would say, to the game of football on field with the introduction of VAR. You know, for yourself, what was, I suppose, your honest take on how it's impacted refereeing and the flow of the game?
Yeah, it's interesting because let me just take it back to the beginning of VAR, because for us, the worst feeling as a referee was coming away from the game knowing that you'd made a match-changing decision. And it was generally the camera from behind the goal where you couldn't possibly see from where you are that showed someone had been tripped or something, and or you'd missed something, or a Thierry Henry handball, whatever it might be. And that driving home was a horrible feeling, right? Because if only I had that camera angle, if only I could have done that. And you beat yourself up about it. So the idea of VAR, which when it first came in, was to get rid of those clangers. Yeah, which is great. So let's say you book someone for diving and the image shows that it's a penalty, clear penalty, or it's a handball off the ball you don't see. Great, it's going to be a new world for us. We as referees never asked for VAR though. Yeah, it was always the clubs. The clubs wanted VAR to come in to eradicate all the errors that referees were making, because even though we weren't making a great deal, the general consensus was that it needed to be better. And in a modern world with technology, why wouldn't you welcome that? So everybody wanted it. So when we first started, it was quite nice to have that comfort blanket. In England, we didn't go to the screen initially. It was just made for us by the VARs. And it was quite nice because you could sell that to the players and you could say, well, I haven't seen it, but they've looked at it, it must be right. And generally on the pitch, it made it easy. We then went through COVID. Again, we were still at that point not going to the screen. And then we made the transition to going to the screen. And then we generally didn't change our decision when we went to the screen. Your mate was looking after you. If they thought you were wrong, they looked at all the camera angles, and then generally, once you went to the screen, we never changed it. And then we sort of worked on having a better conversation at the screen, and therefore, from time to time, we realised that the VARs might misinterpret it, like they did at Chelsea last weekend. And so you would now have the ability to go have a rational conversation and then stick with decision or change it. So that process was good, but what you quickly realize, and I sympathize with Michael Salisbury last week, is everything looks different in slow motion. You don't have the feel. You don't have the feel for what's happening on the pitch. There's no clues to help you. You're very much removed from it. And you quickly realize that. And I put three clips on LinkedIn this week. And for me, they're just clear either a red card or a penalty. And I'd say 50-50 was the responses, or 75-25. And there is your answer to why VAR will always have problems. If it was just black and white, great. But unfortunately, football is shades of grey. And that's where VAR operates. And for any given week and any given decision, half the people will think it's right and half the people will think it's wrong. Within 4 weeks, everyone hates VAR because they've been touched by it and they don't agree with it. It's probably much faster and better than it's ever been. But will it ever be what people want it to be? Probably not. But there's so much money invested in it. I think it'd be very difficult to go back to a world prior to VAR. Undoubtedly, people referee differently. I think the statistics show that people rely on VAR sometimes and don't want to make a decision. We had the Scottish referees over this weekend. They'd just done the Old Firm game, and they came to do a couple of games in Australia. It's a reasonably tight offside that was disallowed for the Rangers goal. The assistant keeps his flag down. I think in the olden days he would have flagged it and just put his flag up and said, I think that's offside. But because we delay and wait and see, I think we've probably rely on VAR a little bit more. And therefore, the art of refereeing and getting those decisions is probably diminished a little bit. It comes too easy to go, oh, well, VAR's corrected it and that's all right. But in order for us to progress as referees, Andre Mariner used to have a phrase which I really like. And he used to say this in his pre-match, was about making VAR redundant. So if you get all the decisions right in the first place, like we used to do, then there's no need for VAR. We should only need VAR for the really difficult decisions, and then number of camera angles, and has the referee got it clearly wrong? The difficulty VAR has sometimes, as we had last week, is it's knowing when football wants you to intervene. So an 18-year-old scores his first goal at Stamford Bridge. There's a small contact on the top of the foot. We're the villains, aren't we? Because we overturn that decision. The fairy tale's not quite there, and you live and die by those moments.
Such a unique one that, realistically, you put it to any football lover, John, could be ref, player, fan, pundit. I think we're still talking about VAR in 10 years. The problem around it may change, but we'll still be talking about it. And in such a low scoring sport like football, it's so unique. It's so different compared to other sports such as tennis and cricket, where we see technology widely and successfully implemented.
Yeah, I think we should just go back. I think in an ideal world, if you could put it back in, you'd just go to just to the clear and obvious. I know that phrase has become synonymous with VAR, but the ones that everyone wants you to intervene on. And I think the bigger issue for me is handball, because how have we got to a point where defenders are defending with their hands behind the back? That tells you that nobody knows what handball is anymore, because whoever coaches someone to defend like that, but such is the fear of a ball hitting an arm and a penalty being awarded and VAR intervening, then that's where we've got to. And that's the bigger issue to me, because we've now got, when I was growing up, you never defended like that. You defended with your arms, you jockeyed, you moved out. Yes, we don't want the hand. That's handball, right? That used to be handball. I've stopped it with my arm. Now it's hand by the side, leaning. Hands behind the back and leaning is now a penalty all of a sudden. So that's the bigger issue for me, is the game is just becoming a little bit diluted. And the game I sort of fell in love with in the first place is it's probably not the same game anymore. And that's probably me sounding like an old man, but you know, I think let's just go back to the basics, and that is what handball used to be, and use technology what we can use, goal line, offside. But even offside, right? The offside law is not really made for the level of technology that we've got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's now, it used to be in the old days, you were off by that much and you thought, oh, that was close. And the system got that wrong, it was okay. But now we're talking about fingernails, aren't we? We're talking about a little tiny blurred image of a boot is now offside. And now we've got this new technology that a computer does it for us. Yeah, it's different, isn't it? It's different now.
I think, you know, it's such a fast-paced sport that, you know, they speak about, you know, subject interpretation, and you're speaking about speed of decision making. You'll see it no clearer, kind of the discrepancies there, you know, at a World Cup, a Club World Cup, could be even a Confederate Championship like the Copa America or European Championships. Just being at the Club World Cup this summer is interesting, being at four games to see, right, which referees allowed the game to flow, which didn't, what were conceived yellow cards, you know, what's handball, what's not, when to use VAR, when not to. And that's at the highest of levels. No, with no shortage of cash. But again, that's, for me, there's a beauty in that too. You know, and
yeah.
I think you don't want to remove that completely from the game, that where it's just so robotic.
Yeah, we want the reason we love football, right, and we all played it and fell in love with it, is because often things happen in games that if you wrote in a book, it would be, no one would believe it, right? So every weekend there's a story. Whether as a Sunderland fan, we've been to Wembley loads of times, got beat. We're always the team that someone scored in the last minute. And then this summer, you know, the fairy tale happened. We were against the run of play, VAR overruled a goal. We're back in the game. We score a great goal in about 79 minutes and then get a winner on 95. The guy who's leaving to go and play for another team, and he's just come on as a sub, and they've all linked together, and it's a magical moment. That's why we like football, right? And I think football fans have started to embrace technology in that the games I've been to where a goal's been scored, you celebrate, and then it's and then the other team are taking the mick out of it. So football fans are really good at making enjoyment out of something that happens, whether it's the other team getting a goal disallowed or whatever it might be, right? It's like I go to the Ashes, the cricket, and we're looking at the spinning bat going round, and that's the highlight. And you're looking at the snickometer, and you're then cheering, aren't you? And we make the best of what we can get. Does it work? Is it fully integrated VAR yet? Probably not. Will it ever be? Probably not. But it is what it is, and we've got to make it work eventually. But we have such high expectations of it that it's never going to meet those expectations, and we're always going to be disappointed.
And it's an interesting one, because obviously you're speaking so openly and honest about it now. There really isn't that culture, I would say, traditionally from the football I'd know, growing up in Ireland, and obviously, you know, the Premier League being that for me growing up, in terms of referees coming out, speaking about decisions. Obviously, the media scrutiny and pressure is big enough. You ever see a time and place where that comes in, and possibly could be England, could be amongst the top five leagues? Because for me, just being on the other end of this conversation today, I think no matter who's listening to this, you know, they'll be able to put themselves in your shoes, hear you out, listen to it. And obviously this is not the emotion of a Sunderland or a Chelsea or a Liverpool playing, but being able to put themselves in your shoes and being able to sympathise. You see that coming into our game anytime soon?
I think the big thing at the minute is fan engagement, whether it be through PGMO, have got their own social media channels. They put things out all the time. Other referees have, and we do as well in Australia, we put things out in terms of hearing the comms, you know, Willie Collum, it does the VAR show now on Sky Sports. Howard does the Mike Duff
Gallagher,
show. Yeah. So it's all about informing the general public. You have to think as a referee, what is the benefit of me coming out afterwards to this to talk about a decision? You'd never want to come and talk to me when I played a great advantage. So that's the equivalent of scoring a wonder goal at top corner that leads to a goal. I always use the analogy of the goalkeeper who gets a back pass, miscontrols it, and it ends up in the back of the net. I have watched football and I've seen that happen loads of times. I have never once seen the goalkeeper come out and be interviewed afterwards and explain why he miscontrolled it and ended up in the back of the net. And that's because he only all he'd say is, I miscontrolled it and it ends up in the back of the net. But what happens instead? The manager comes out, protects him. So they talk about something else and they move on. If we were standing in front of the cameras, we'd just be saying, well, from my angle, this is what it looked like. And that's why I got it wrong. So I don't think there's any benefit of that. What is beneficial has been for you, the public, to be able to hear the comms. So this is why we got to that decision. You might not agree with it, but this is the process they went through. This is what they got to. And the reason that they got the decision wrong at Chelsea last week is because as a VAR, you become fixated by one thing. It's a bit like going on YouTube at 10 o'clock at night. And then before you know it, it's you're watching videos of an old band you used to like, and it's 2 in the morning. Yeah. And you're thinking, how did I get, where's those 4 hours gone? Well, just imagine that magnified into a really small time. And you come fixated by this foot on the foot. Yeah, it's definitely a foul. It must be a foul. That's what it looks like. And then you put that context with the game where no one wanted it. It's just someone standing on the foot. And then you misread it. And that's why you get to the wrong outcome. But if you think about you playing five-a-side with your mates, you'll stand on each other's feet all the time. You'll be clumsy. There'll be contact. But not everything needs to be stopped and played. You just accept it. That's what we need to... need to look at something full speed. Is anyone asking for it? Do we need to get involved? No, we don't. Let's keep out of it. That should be our starting point. Why are we looking for things that no one wants to find out about? That's a real different concept to what we want. We think we should get everything right. But football never, ever works like that.
Really good perspective too. And, you know, it's interesting. We've begun at the start. You know, you took us through your period as a PE teacher, obviously beginning the classroom, speaking about this wonderful officiating career. Now talk to us more about what you're doing with the latest cohort of referees coming through in Australia.
Yeah, so I've been here for a year now, and so I'm in charge of all the referees in Australia. So we're doing a lot of work with the A-League referees. So Ali Reza, you talked about the World Club Cup, which was in America over the summer. Well, Ali Reza did the final. It was the first time we'd had three Australian officials ever do a FIFA final, which was fantastic for us. We also have been doing in-stadium announcements for a year. So everything that is happening in England now, we've had that for over a year in Australia, and it's been really exciting in terms of fan engagement. We just keep it really simple. We try to make it a bit of Hollywood, and we try to get the information to the fans, but it's really, we don't use any technical speak. We just say things like it's a foul and therefore I'm giving the penalty. That's what you want to know as a football fan. Why is it? Yeah, he's fouled him and I'm going to give a pen. Doesn't have to be anything more complicated than that. We've also got a really good group of female officials coming through. We're hoping that a couple of them might, you know, do well in the Women's World Cup. We've got the Asian Cup in Australia next year. So we're really excited about that. And we've got this really exciting cohort coming through. So we've got a young referee academy for 16 to 18 year olds. Some of them have just done the first professional games, which is a groundbreaking thing at 17. We've also, our Australian Cup is the equivalent of the FA Cup. We decided not to use any professional referees until the quarterfinals. So we give lots of grassroots, up and coming young referees a chance, and they were brilliant. So one of the good things about being in Australia, we take risks. The girls and boys are super keen. They're really fit, and they just embrace everything that we try to teach them. And they listened. We had the Scottish guys over. They did a couple of workshops. They were really well attended. They're just really hungry for knowledge. We've got an exchange with Japan and Scotland, Northern Ireland. So we're working on different ways to give our referees experience. And we're trying to make sure that all our officials are respected, well paid, even at grassroots level, and they feel as safe as possible. So we've had a body cam trial in one of our states, which has cut dissent down. We've had one incident of dissent since the cameras have been used, and that was by a spectator. So I think things are moving in the right direction. We've got some money off the government in terms of female participation. I think in Australia, female sport is a lot further forward than it felt like in England. In England, football was very tribal, and it tends to be men going to matches. And whereas over here with AFL and NRL, we're the highest participant sport is football in Australia. But in terms of media and stuff, AFL and NRL, a bit like the NFL, and is ahead of it. But we're getting there. We're making progress, and I'm really enjoying it. They're a great group to work with, and people have let us try different things. And yeah, I think it's an exciting time, and carried on the good work that was done by people before me. So just trying to work hard and improve referees slowly. And we made history in that we had two female officials on the grand final for the first time, one on the field and one in the we had a female VAR. We also the FA Cup final, Australian Cup final, is two females on the line, which is the first time in history. We had an all-female team on the January the 1st. So we're trying to break down those barriers and traditions and give people opportunity. And we're trying to create as many different pathways. And if you're good enough, we'll give you a go. And it's up to you to take that opportunity is our mantra, and for you to own that moment if you get a chance.
Sounds like an unbelievably exciting time, and obviously what a project to be a part of, trailblazing but that grassroots initiative as well. Wow, really, really eye-opening. But I mean, that's what this podcast has been. I felt today, John, really, really enlightening. Obviously I came in with an array of talking points, but you get lost in the wonderful insight that you give, and just even the insight into being a Premier League referee. Absolutely amazing, and it's a credit to yourself and the journey you've been on. For as we begin to wrap up, for anyone that's listening who is that slightly bit inspired by your own career journey to date, what would be the one bit of key advice you'd have for them?
I think if you want to be involved in top level sport, the best seat in the house is that of the referee. It's exciting. It's becoming cool. It's becoming sexy. I'd say go and give it a go. And you might just enjoy yourself. And who knows where it'll take you from me sort of going out on a Sunday morning and my first game in Leeds, to Wembley, to referee in front of millions of people. I've ended up going all around the world, and now I'm in Australia. Unless you start the journey, you'll never find out where it's going to take you. So have a go. It's a great career. It's a great way of keeping fit. There's going to be ups and downs, but it's very fulfilling. And I'd say give it a go, because there's never been a better time to be a referee, whether you're male, female, black, white, whatever gender. Give it a go.
Fantastic. John Moss, it was great having you on the show today.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.